Hello and welcome to the Inside Transportation Podcast. If you care even one bit about Tesla, you need to know about Omar Kazi. Omar may be one of the most well-informed experts on all things Tesla and the electric vehicle space, and he also has some crazy stories about everything that's going on in the space. He was kind enough to join me today on the podcast. Thanks for joining me, Omar. How's it going?
Yeah, good to talk to you, Johan. That was quite an introduction.
Yeah. So you scared a lot of the EV world earlier this week when you deactivated your Twitter account for a brief moment. And I think it's funny because traditional journalists always tend to see Tesla supporters as pests. Yet right. They love using your reports for their own stories and they don't even give you a thank you. So I partially wanted to just jump on this podcast and thank you for all the content and all the news and all the breaks you've been giving us over the past few years. So I'll let you gloat a little bit in that if you want to. But
I don't know if there's anything to gloat about. I mean, from my perspective, you know, we just write the dumbest tweets and articles possible, but there is a lot of interesting stuff going on in, you know, the AEV revolution, and it's just really exciting what's happening right now.
I mean, you've uncovered a lot of good shit though, right? Like I have some examples here, by the way. So you asked Elon, this was last year, you asked him if the Tesla app could have insurance cards. Do you remember doing this tweet, like asking if it could display insurance cards and you could file claims? And Elon said, definitely. I don't know if that's a feature yet, but if they're working on it, that's all you're undertaking. You shared this like cool video last year of just like you and your Model 3, like looping through LAX with like autopilot engaged. And like you just continually just try to like advance like the EV movement, not just Tesla, but like some of these other automakers too. Like you look into shit and you like evaluate it. And for that, like, I respect you. And I think like you deserve like some credit for like advancing this movement forward for sure.
Well, I mean, that's kind of surprising to me, for me to hear. I always, you know, I kind of fell into this stuff unexpectedly. And I guess looking back on it, I kind of fell deep into it. And now I'm deep into it. Really deep into it. Yeah. But you know, when I was starting, I was just a software developer, who got a Model 3. You know, I reserved my Model 3 pretty much the day after the unveil. And a couple years later, they contacted me and they said, okay, we got your car. Do you want it? And I said, yeah. And I got the car, and, it was kind of crazy what was happening. I mean, the Model 3 ramp was a make-or-break moment for Tesla as a company, and really for electric vehicles in general. I mean, this was a moment where, if executed well, it changes Tesla forever. Not just Tesla, it changes the whole world forever. But if executed poorly, the company was dead. Just probably bankrupt, right? If anything went wrong, and there was a million things that could go wrong, if customers didn't like the car, if they weren't able to produce enough, if you know, a number of things happened, they were just done. And a lot of people wanted the company to go bankrupt, either just because they were amused or because they were in one of the many industries that Tesla was challenging. I mean, if you're in oil and gas, if you're in legacy automakers making polluting cars, if you're in the traditional energy industry, any of these fields, it's really comforting to think, oh, this whole thing about Tesla, you know, taking on oil and gas and everything, it was all just a joke. This company is just an unprofitable, terrible company, and they're going to go bankrupt soon. That was really, you know, funny that people thought someone could challenge us. And then, of course, there were also the short sellers, people who were making money betting against Tesla stock. So they make money if the stock goes down. And they all just kind of came together to push this really crazy disinformation campaign on Twitter, where they were all using these anonymous Twitter accounts. I mean, it was Twitter primarily, but they would all use these anonymous Twitter accounts and just kind of post all this misleading information to try and create a perfect storm where, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. enough things go wrong that it hurts the stock price and they can't raise money and there's a loss of confidence with customers and investors, and we actually push them under, through this disinformation campaign. So that's when I created the Steve Jobs Tesla Truth account to just kind of parody what they were doing, right? Because I realized with my Omar Kazi Twitter account, there was no way I could respond to the amount of misinformation they were pushing and say, hey, this isn't true. Look at this with my car. It's actually a good car. And there was just no way to respond to the massive amount of information. So I said, you know, I'll make an anonymous account too to talk about this subject and just kind of parody what they're doing. You know, they're making all these random Elon, you know, anonymous accounts, not specifying their name, something like Elon is a fraud or whatever. So I made Steve Jobs. And, you know, I would actually tweet just pretending to be Steve Jobs, like as a joke, and just talk about what was happening at Tesla, show what was really happening with the products. And I never thought it would be, anything. I never thought that anybody would notice, or, you know, nobody had ever read anything I'd written, or I'd never done any blogging or podcasting or anything like that. But it ended up causing a lot of controversy. And still to this day, like in that community, if you're a Tesla short seller, you know, I'm probably very infamous. They really don't like me. One of them is suing me and Elon at the moment. Damn. And
how is that, by the way? Like, obviously you don't have to give us the details of the legal case that you can't discuss, but just what's that experience like being sued along with Elon Musk over like Tesla shit? Isn't that just mind-blowing to you? Like, because you're just a normal guy who just wanted to tweet about his Model 3.
Yeah, I mean, I almost think if I could go back, I'd say, don't tweet about your car, just don't get into it, because you have no idea what these people are going to do to you. But yeah, you know, some of these people are just really crazy. I mean, I started tweeting about the short sellers and what they were doing, and the guy who's suing me, Aaron Greenspan, you know, he said that he invented Facebook. So he thought that he invented Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg stole the idea from him.
Truth to that, or any validation that you've researched?
So, you know, there is actually a little bit of truth to it. So he was at Harvard with Mark Zuckerberg.
Oh, shit. And I didn't know that.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And he created this app called House System. And Zuckerberg actually created an account and used this. And he met with Aaron Greenspan, this Tesla short seller who's just been, you know, going after me and, you know, trying to destroy me. And he said, hey, would you like to come work with us on Facebook? And Greenspan said, well, no, why would I go work for you? I've already got my own thing here. And, you know, I've started this company in high school, and why would I go work for you? So he turned down the chance to go work with Mark Zuckerberg on Facebook. And, you know, he felt that Zuckerberg kind of took some of his ideas and it kind of inspired him for Facebook. And, you know, it's kind of funny because you look at what Mark Zuckerberg has been doing since, you know, Instagram copying Snapchat, Instagram copying, you know, TikTok now with the Reels feature. Yeah. There is kind of some truth to it that, you know, maybe that's his strength, that Zuckerberg sees these things and he's able to kind of, you know, channel it into his product. But obviously he was very upset about that. And then he wrote a story telling, you know, his story about how Mark Zuckerberg stole Facebook from him. And the guy who was making the movie The Social Network read that book as a, trying to get a sense for what was happening at Harvard at the time. And then after suing Zuckerberg for stealing the idea from Facebook from him, you know, he sued the makers of The Social Network for stealing his story and not putting him in the movie. And, when I started talking about this, he got really, really upset. And he did a lot of things to basically, you know, try and get my Twitter account taken down. He actually got my Twitter accounts taken down and other things taken down. He, you know, filed a police report against me, tried to frame me for having, you know, child pornography and get me arrested. And he started these conspiracy theories that Elon was paying me and that I wasn't, you know, a normal Tesla fan. I was being paid by Elon. I was actually part of the PR team, and that I had this partner named Jim, and that Jim and I were working together. There's nobody named Jim. And, you know, so he just started these conspiracy theories, and, you know, this whole kind of short seller group started harassing me. Now he's suing me. It's kind of a frivolous lawsuit, but, you know.
I guess, like, my question is, how does he even figure out who you are, right? Because if you think about it, if you're running this anonymous Twitter account, how was he able to, like, uncover that you were Omar Kazi? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
how did he put, like, one and one together and kind of, like, find you? That's, like, fucking mind-blowing.
Yeah, so he doxed me on my birthday when I turned 25. It was, you know, I posted about his thing about, you know, this guy who's a Tesla short seller. He's posting all this anti-Tesla information. He thinks he invented Facebook. And I was kind of laughing. I mean, it's just such a funny situation, you know, that he thinks he invented Facebook and then he sued the makers of the social network. And, you know, he was really upset about that. So he DM'd me and he said, you know, delete this tweet immediately. And he had a link. So I clicked on the link and he said, you know, thanks. Now I have your IP address.
And so
he kind of, you know, tried to trick me that way. But I said, OK, you know, whatever. He's got my IP address. What's he going to do? Mm-hmm. But then earlier I had been going on his website. You know, he has this website where he basically has legal documents and he kind of uses it to, you know, threaten people or look up lawsuits against Tesla and post, you know, allegations about them for his short selling bets and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so he had seen that my same IP address had searched for, you know, the name of business and my name. And then he said, OK, with 99% certainty, this is Omar. And then he posted my name and my workplace online, you know, to kind of the Tesla short seller community, which, you know, they call doxing. And, you know, I thought, well, you know, what's the big deal? You know, my identity wasn't really a secret. If anyone asked, I would tell them, you know, who right. I was. Yeah. It wasn't really that I was trying to be anonymous. It was just kind of parodying what the short sellers were doing with their anonymous accounts. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, so I said, okay, what's the big deal? You know, but I never could have imagined that, you know, they would be threatening me and start finding my parents' business and, you know, threatening me, going, you know, to the office there and vandalizing it and just texting me weird things like, you know, I'm at Del Taco. There's a Del Taco next to our office. So just like a lot of weird and creepy things and threats and legal DMCA notices, stuff like that, to just try and get me pulled off Twitter and right. other websites.
And, so, and just for reference for our listeners, I mean, this was the Tesla _ truth account, correct? That he was trying to pull down?
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was a fan favorite of so many of the people who subscribe to the newsletter that I write. They fucking loved that account. And then one day, magically, yeah. And let me just recount what happened. That account goes down, and mysteriously, Elon stops tweeting. Do you remember that?
Well, Elon was very pissed about that specifically, and one other thing. You know, so what happened was, you know, Bloomberg wanted to interview me for a feature they were doing on autopilot, uh-huh. and Aaron just went crazy when he found out. And the day that I was being interviewed by this journalist, Zach Mitre, for Bloomberg about autopilot, he sent an email to the Tesla board of directors, the entire board of directors and Elon and all the major journalists covering the story, Russ Mitchell, Laura, you know, Kolodny, Dana Hall, all these people. And he said, this person who you have interviewed fooled you. He is paid by Tesla. And he is paid by Elon to, you know, threaten people and, you know, try and he has child pornography and he's trying to just all this crazy stuff. And he sent this email to the entire Tesla board of directors and all these media outlets. And the journalist who was interviewing me that day forwarded to me and he said, hey, you know, look at what this guy just emailed to the entire Tesla board of directors. And then you know, the journalist was asking me, you know, is this true? And I said, no, you know, this guy is, you know, kind of upset with me. And then the day the story was published on October 9th, he threatened to sue me and Elon. He sent me and Elon an email and he said, you know, you need to preserve all evidence because I'm going to file a lawsuit against you. Wow. And me and Elon just laughed. I mean, I think yeah. Elon said, does this psych ward know you have a cell phone? And I think I've seen that tweet
actually. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good one. And I just said, LOL. And then the day after that, he filed a police report against me with the San Francisco Police Department, October 10th, the day this after the story was published. Mm-hmm. And he posted this whole Twitter thread. And he said, you know, Dana Hull and Zach Mitre got fooled. This isn't a real Tesla fan. This is someone paid by Elon and Tesla. He's with their PR team, and he's been working with this guy named Jim. And they totally got fooled. He's not a real person at all. It's all Tesla PR. Just like this this crazy conspiracy stuff that he told the short sellers. And, you know, they believed it, or at least pretended to believe it. Mm-hmm. You know, sent in a bunch of complaints to Twitter for like impersonation, and sent in DMCA notices, said I was, you know, violating his copyright by sharing a photo of him and that kind of thing, and got the Twitter accounts pulled down. I kind of hope it sounds like through this lawsuit we might be able to maybe get it back.
The DSMA takedown notice because you were using Steve Jobs' picture and they said that was impersonation? Was that what it was?
Yeah, well, so, yes. So he would basically just stalk my Twitter account. Anything I would send, and even to this day, anything I do anywhere online, he immediately gets a copy. Like, he'll react within, like, 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And he would basically try and find technicalities to try and get the Twitter account removed. And it got suspended 3 or 4 times before it was, before they said, you know, it's been suspended too many times. We're not going to unsuspend it. And the first time was for impersonation. So, you know, impersonating Steve Jobs. Obviously, no one's going to think I'm Steve Jobs because he's...
Right, and it's a parody account. It said it in the bio line. And, like, technically, when you look at the policies of, like, these social media platforms, as long as you say it's a parody account, you can use whatever profile picture
yeah.
you want.
Well, yeah. So before that, I didn't write that it was a parody account in the bio. You know, I hadn't reviewed the Twitter rules extensively. Yeah. So that was the first thing, was impersonation. Then it was, you know, copyright infringement, because I said, hey, look, this is the guy who's been, you know, stalking me and going after me, Aaron Greenspan. And then he sent a, you know, copyright notice. He said, hey, this is a copyrighted picture. And we now know, you know, he didn't even have a copyright on that picture. But when they get a DMCA notice, they have to take it down, you know,
right.
if they want to have their safe harbor status. And, you know, he just knew the law much better than I did. I mean, these are like old 40-year-old balding men who were teaming up against me. I was, you
know,
25 at
the time. Well,
they also
probably have the resources to, like,
yeah.
you know, consult a lawyer or get a legal team behind you and try to find every possible avenue to, like, take down your Twitter, which, by the way, like, personally, I think that's bullshit, right? Because in America, we have freedom of speech, right? And it doesn't say, like, oh, you can only use your freedom of speech, like, in this certain, like, capacity, right? Or on this platform. And, like, if you want to spew whatever you think about Tesla, whether it's good or bad, you should be allowed to do that. And people shouldn't, like, just try to take you down because you're saying something unfavorable, right? That's just my personal thoughts on it, though.
Well, yeah. You know, I think that the ironic thing is these people were putting out so much just terrible, negative, just harassing innocent Tesla customers, not just me. You know, this isn't an isolated incident. There are many, many people who have been affected by this stuff. Even, you know, Sandy Monroe is looking at suing them now because, you know, he just lost an $8 million contract due to people accusing him of being paid by Tesla.
Which is insane, because, you know, I've talked to Sandy and he's the most, like, he will, if something's
bullshit.
Fucked up, right? He will tell you, yeah, this car company is fucked up. I mean, in the past, he said their cars were shitty, right?
Yeah.
Like, he said stuff like that.
When the Model 3 first came out, he said, this is the worst body I've ever seen for manufacturing. This is not easy to make at all, you know?
Right, right. But yeah. So I guess my question to you about journalists, right? Because like you mentioned some of those names earlier, like what's his name again? Guy from the LA Times, Russ Mitchell.
Russ Mitchell.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, and some of these other journalists that cover the space. Do you think, because I've heard this rumor kind of along the lines of people who support Tesla, do you legitimately think that they're members of Tesla Q and are being paid for by someone for like having this unfavorable coverage? Or do you think it's just an ego thing? Because like my perspective on it is I think some journalists that are out there working for some of these traditional media outlets, right? I personally think that they just have big egos and they hate Elon Musk and they hate Tesla in some capacity. So some of the stories they have aren't necessarily like, you know, including the good and the bad of the company, right? They're just kind of focused on the negativity. It seems like, right? Based on like what I've read, some of the clips I've reviewed from some of these like journalists, like, I don't know, what are some of your thoughts there?
Well, it would be very, very shocking if, for example, Russ Mitchell was being paid by somebody. He is very close with the short sellers. I mean, they're the only people he follows on Twitter. He donated $50 to Aaron Greenspan's, you know, charity, quote unquote. He has this 501c3 nonprofit. You know, so he's donating money to them, you know, working closely with them, but is he necessarily getting paid? You know, I found that it's actually amazing what people will do for non-monetary payment. Just somebody who wants a community, right? They would just want friends. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at, you know, Aaron, he had like 600 followers. He'd never had any, you know, friends in his life. And he felt that he'd just been spurned by everyone, by Zuckerberg and by Silicon Valley. Face Cash failed, and just having that community of short sellers where, you know, I saw somebody say, it was kind of a young person, you know, doing their CFA, and he said, you know, I lost most of my life saving shorting Tesla, but It was such a great experience and I learned so much and I met the best people. And I was like, you know, you lost most of your life savings, but, you know, you still had a good time with this online community tweeting. And that was kind of how I got sucked into it, too. I mean, they just waged this amazing disinformation campaign that was funny, right? They had memes and the narrative they told was engaging, right? This kind of alternate reality of a failing Tesla. And they were so good at making you believe it. They made even, you know, the most hardcore believers question what they thought was true. So it's really interesting. And, you know, I think that you don't necessarily need to pay people anymore just for, you know, attention, for engagement, for feeling important. They can actually suck real people into their disinformation campaign who don't even know that they're part of it just by telling them this story, and then people believe it and they repeat it. And then it has this extra air of legitimacy that it's not coming from an oil or gas company. It's just in the population.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing in specific, and obviously, you know, I don't know this guy, but Russ Mitchell, I think he wanted to fight Elon in like a
a wrestling like cage match right? or something. Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, you know, look, I went to journalism school. I just know that's like that's not right. Like as a journalist, you're not supposed to be doing that kind of shit, right? It's just not acceptable. Like you shouldn't be doing that because then you're just kind of throwing out all your credibility out of the door, right? And like for me personally, I think people who are covering Tesla, there's so many great journalists out there that are doing great work on Tesla, like doing stuff on the good and doing stuff on the bad, right? But like that kind of rhetoric or that kind of like, dude, I'm going to physically fight Elon. I don't know if it was a joke or if he legitimately thought. I mean, I legitimately think he wants to fight like Elon, right?
Yeah.
But I just
I mean,
think
imagine
that's
what he's saying in private.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's just like, dude, like you're supposed to be a writer for one of the biggest publications in the United States, right? And like in Los Angeles, which by the way is the biggest fucking car market in like America,
right?
And it just seems like you shouldn't be doing that kind of work. Like you should actually be doing like journalism instead of just kind of like putting yourself into this fight.
Yeah.
I guess like,
well, it is very shocking. And, you know, it shocked me to see that there were these anti-Tesla journalists, you know, like, for example, you know, Lynette Lopez, has a good relationship with Jim Chanos, like one of the famous short sellers, and all these journalists who were just so clearly on one side of the issue. And you think,
right.
I mean, this classic venerated tradition of American journalism, that journalists are impartial, that they're able to converse with one side just as easily as the other side, rather than, you know, blocking all of one side and only conversing with the other side. So it was very shocking, but I think it's really part of this trend you've seen where the internet has really fundamentally destroyed the business model of journalism. And what journalism needs is a new business model. And what we have right now is a situation where, you know, people are very, you really have to get people's attention. You really have to make them want to click. And it's a lot easier to play to one side rather than being impartial. I mean, impartial, nobody cares, right? Nobody gets excited about impartial. Nobody says, I want to go sponsor this paper and run ads in here, or I really like what this guy is saying, I'm going to make sure to do it again. And I mean, who are the advertisers in the LA Times, right? They're
car companies, right?
Yeah, a lot of car companies. It's a huge car market. And, you know, Toyota and Honda had their headquarters here until very recently. I think Toyota's in Texas. Right, yeah.
And then I think so Nissan moved to Tennessee. The only automakers that are still out in California are Honda. Honda's still in Torrance.
Yeah.
Kia's out in Irvine. Hyundai's in Mountain Valley. And then I think that's it. I don't know if anyone else is still out in SoCal.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm sure the advertisers loved it. You know, if you're advertising a car and Russ Mitchell's writing a story about how, you know, Tesla's terrible, and the guy was thinking about buying a Tesla, but he says, oh, well, Tesla's terrible. And look, there's an ad for a, you know, Hummer, or they don't sell those anymore. There's an ad for an F-150 here on the newspaper right next to this article that Russ wrote. So, you know, it works out quite well, I think. And
I hope that like the LA Times does have that separation between like editorial and advertising, right? Because like nowadays, I don't know about you, but like when you read news sometimes, it's like sponsored content. It looks like it's real content, but it's an advertisement. And like you said, I mean, these business models are just, you know, really shitty. So ad salespeople have to see every way possible that they can kind of sell advertising, right? And I've heard of some instances where like editorial and ads are getting a little too close at some organizations, right? So I hope that he's not influenced by that. I personally just think he has a big ego and he fucking hates Elon.
A lot of these old auto industry guys, they don't like this idea that someone new is going to come in and just everything they know about cars, you know, I know about, you know, how to change a carburetor, or, you know, how to fix an engine, you know, all this kind of knowledge about cars that they have, that they've built their whole life. You know, some computer guy coming in and saying, hey, guess what? This is all irrelevant now. What matters now is software. What matters now is this entirely new technology that you don't know anything about. And, you know, there's naturally going to be resistance. You see that in anything where people who are kind of the hardcore users are resistant. But, you know, that's not most people.
Right, yeah. And I will say this. I do think Tesla needs to advertise. You know, obviously, Elon's big shtick is, hey, you know, we're running this company. We're not running any ads. We're not running any marketing campaigns. This is all just going to be like people to people driven, right? Or driven organically. But to some extent, like, I do think that there's going to be this turning point, right? Where just like Apple with the iPhone, like you saw the first people who bought an iPhone were just like early adopters, people who read like Engadget and Gizmodo and all these tech blogs, right? And then there is an infliction point where like iPhone landed on Verizon, and then it landed on Sprint, and then it landed on T-Mobile, and then you started seeing this like wider user base of people who like didn't know what a you know 30-pin like cable was, right? Or didn't know like what iTunes was. And I still think that even though like we're kind of in this bubble, I think because we're just so like we're early adopters and we're like tech heads and we just love to like be really engaged in this scene, but there's still like a huge percentage of Americans that think like an electric car travels 50 miles on a charge and like it's gonna, you know, drain your whole like electricity bill and it's gonna make it really expensive and all this stuff, right? And I think like one thing Tesla can really do is like come out with more like advertising, right? And say like, hey, like this is a Tesla, like this is how you use it, this is what it does to the environment, stuff like that,
right?
And because otherwise you're gonna see like GM and all these other automakers like take the charge when it comes to advertising because they also need to start selling electric cars, right? So I don't know what some of your thoughts are on that. I know it's going to be one of the topics on the upcoming shareholders meeting, but
yeah. Well, I think Elon did say that they're going to consider advertising now. You know, they said make something, you know, artistic and to inform customers. It did actually get to the point where literally, you know, shareholders are demanding it, or some. And some people feel very strongly that they shouldn't advertise, but somebody actually put it on the ballot for the shareholders to vote on. Right. And
I think
the board recommended
that they vote no, right?
Yeah. I think the no they're going to do advertising eventually. In the past, where they had very tight margins and they were unprofitable, you know, advertising wasn't necessarily the best idea, especially when their production was so constrained that if they advertised, they probably wouldn't be able to meet the additional demand. But, you know, Apple made some great ads back in the day. They were always fun, and it would be great to see some Tesla ads. I think in the future, we'll start to see them. And it's so true. People have so many misconceptions. Like, I gave people some Uber rides in my Model 3, just kind of part-time when I first got the car. And it's just interesting, right? I mean, what people say... the most common thing I heard was, I've never been in a Tesla before, you know, or I've never been in an electric vehicle before. Yeah. And, you know, people said, oh, so these cost like $100,000, right? Oh, no, it costs $35,000. Wow. You know, people just don't know this stuff. Right. And there's so many misconceptions, many that have been pushed by people who don't want people to know that an electric vehicle can be a better car.
Right. And I think like some of that idea comes around like range anxiety, because the reality is like most people drive to the grocery store, to the doctor, to like, you know, drop their kids off at the soccer game. And maybe total they'll drive like 20 miles in a day. Right.
Right.
But you have a car that drives 300 miles on a single charge. Right. And some people still think that's not enough. They're like, oh, I'm worried if I, you know, get this car, I'm not going to be able to do a road trip to San Francisco and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
And the reality is, like, there's charge points that like, you know, the V3 supercharger can charge in like what?
Yeah.
15 minutes, 20 minutes?
It's 5 crazy. Minutes you can add 100 miles.
Yeah, that's crazy, right? And I think like those kinds of like revelations or those kinds of selling points, like, I think Tesla should be doing a better job kind of putting that out there to people who like aren't necessarily reading Electric or like Green Car Reports or some of these publications, right? That kind of inform us or follow you on Twitter, right? To kind of inform like the general population. It's just my opinion.
I think you're totally right. And that's kind of what's needed to get to this next mass market phase. I mean, for people who don't know that much about electric vehicles, people are always talking about charging. It's this huge hassle. It's actually the opposite of what you think. And people don't know this because this is such new technology. Right. But for most people, you never have to go anywhere to fill. You know, do you like going to the gas station?
Overnight.
Yeah.
Me personally?
Nobody likes going.
No.
Yeah. No. Nobody likes going to the gas station. For me, back when I had to have a gas car, I would always need gas when I was just the most late to the, you know, most important thing, right? I would never think in advance and get the gas. It's only when, you know, you're already 30 minutes late that you have to get gas, and you go there and you're waiting in line and the credit card thing and yuck, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So with most EV usage, I mean, I never go anywhere to charge. My car charges while I sleep. It's really, really convenient. You know, just calculate the value of the time you save by not going to do that. And for road trips, people think, oh, I'm going to be limited. It's an EV. With the supercharger network, it's actually better. You know, you plug it right in. In, you know, 5 minutes, you can get 75 to 100 miles of charge, which is enough to get you, you know, pretty much anywhere unless you're on a long road trip. And with autopilot plus the supercharger network, which is a lot cheaper than buying gas, it's actually a way better road trip experience in a Tesla than anything else. I mean, taking
You know, Steve Wozniak, I heard him do a talk about his favorite electric cars, because he has both a Chevy Bolt and a Model 3. And it's kind of crazy because he's like, yeah, the Chevy Bolt, I actually enjoy driving more. But as a road trip car, like the Model 3 can't be beat because of the supercharger network, right?
Right.
But I guess like my question to you is like, if you couldn't make any improvements on any Tesla vehicle, what would you do? Because like personally for me, based on what like the experiences I've had, I mean, I have a friend who has a Tesla. I've spent a lot of time in it. I would say two things. One, I definitely think it's time to refresh the Model S. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but like, secondly, I think the interior like should be improved a little bit more. Like, I think there's definitely room to get on that like luxury level with the Model S, like make it really fucking baller. You know what I mean? Like a really baller interior. Because I think like as time progresses, like the Model S is really going to be key to kind of just get margin, right? Because it's a luxury car at that point. So like, I'm sure there's a lot of buyers right now who are on the fence of getting like a Model 3 performance and a Model S. And they're like, well, you know, I don't really see the differences. Let me just get a Model 3. Right. I don't know what some of your thoughts are there.
Yeah. So on the Model S, I mean, the Model S and the Model X are just the greatest cars ever. If you get into the car, I think it's still just light years ahead of anybody else from any other car maker. And, you know, people have been kind of saying this a lot, that, you know, it feels like it needs a refresh with, you know, the 3 and the Y coming in and they're all new. But I think, you know, they're still just hands down the best cars that you can get. I mean, the S goes 0 to 60 in 2.3 seconds. They're just so much fun, so practical. Just still number one, without a doubt. I know that they are working on something called the Plaid drivetrain, which is going to be really amazing. So it's got three motors, two in the back and one in the front. Elon says it's like alien technology, just amazing to drive. And probably they're going to make some other changes. You know, I mean, I can imagine that, you know, if you're going to make some changes to the S, when you're doing the new drivetrain and the new battery pack, it's going to be bigger than 100 kilowatt hours. They'll probably make some changes too. How big the change is, I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised to see something. We've definitely heard a lot of rumors about it going a long time back.
For years, I think, like two or three years now. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the one change that everyone keeps saying is going to happen is they're going to drop that infotainment screen. They're going to go for the one that's used in the Model Y and the 3.
Yeah. So which would make sense. Yeah. A lot of speculation about that, about going, you know, landscape instead of portrait. But I mean, we'll have to see. I'm not really sure, but the Plaid will probably be great. In general, you know, people say this a lot about, you know, a luxury interior, you know, and I think this is kind of like one of the most common misconceptions among, you know, people who don't drive a Tesla, that, you know, BMW has these, you know, fine leather interiors, all these luxuries, you know, all these random features. And, you know, I had a 3 Series before I had my Model 3. So, you know, I'm a fan. It was a lot of fun. I really liked that car. But, you know, I didn't feel going from my BMW to my Model 3 that it was less luxurious. I mean, the Model 3 is very simple. There's almost just nothing there, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like no car, right? So it's just very simple.
There's no buttons, there's nothing. Yeah. It's just a screen and you and that's it.
It's just very plain. And, you know, some people would say, you know, this isn't luxurious. I definitely, you know, disagree with that. I think what they've really done is just, you just see what's around you. And it's just amazing with autopilot. There's just, you know, the whole roof is glass. All the sides are just very open. On the Model X, you have the windshield actually going over your head, which just looks amazing. That's a really
cool experience, by the way.
Yeah.
I love that car.
Yeah, it's really nice. You have to go check it out, anybody who hasn't tried it. And, I mean, when I'm in my car, I'm looking at just the beautiful scenery that I'm rushing through on autopilot, listening to some good music. That to me is luxury. I'm not looking at the inside of the car. If you're looking at the inside of your car, I think you're probably, you know, not enjoying.
I guess you make a really good point, which is I think this definition of luxury interior has totally changed, right?
Yeah.
Because now with technology, like that's the luxury interior in a way. Mm-hmm. Having autopilot, that's luxury, right? Having a really dope infotainment system. Because like, you know, dude, I have a Subaru. Like, have you ever seen the infotainment system on a Subaru? It's fucking shitty. Like, it never works. Well, you know, and all that
all
stuff,
of them
right?
are. All
yeah,
of them
yeah.
are.
No, but it really is like a, like automakers really need to get their shit together, right? Because it's like, you can't even pair your phone on Bluetooth on some of these cars, right? And then you use the Tesla infotainment system and it's so fluid and it's almost like you're using a tablet or a computer and it's so filled with function and it's always being updated.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think that's what luxury interior might be nowadays.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely something to that. I mean, I think, you know, luxury is technology and Tesla is the first kind of post-smartphone car design. It's the first car design that's actually built for autonomy from the beginning. People say like, oh, why isn't there a screen in front of the wheel? Well, Tesla would say, you're not going to need it when your car is driving itself. You don't need to see all the stuff in front of you because you're just going to be enjoying the scenery. But there's also a bit of necessity to it. I mean, this was the magic of the Model 3. The thing is, people are not going to pay more for an EV. If you're talking about mass market adoption, you've got to get the price at or below what a gas car would be at for you to really see mass market adoption. I mean, that's just basic economics. So you've got this really tough problem. You've got a battery pack that costs $10,000. I mean, your best, if you have a really good pack level cost, it's going to be $100 a kilowatt hour. That's like amazing. Most people are probably like 125 or more, even 150 or even above in some cases, I'm sure. But let's say $100 per kilowatt hour would be, you know, state of the art. For, you know, that means a $10,000.
I know that's the goal that everybody's trying to get to, that or below.
That's right. So $100 is, I don't know who came up with this, but generally considered the level at which EVs reach cost parity with polluting cars. So even at that level, right, the golden level, a Model S battery costs $10,000. A long range Model 3 battery costs $7,500. A standard range battery costs $5,000. So this is pretty expensive, right? How do you make a car that can compete with a gas car on price while having this $10,000 part that the other car doesn't have? So what Tesla had to do is really go from the top to bottom and cut out every cost that they could without making it feel like, you know, they were cutting back. And you're never going to out-luxury BMW and Audi. You know, you're just not. Right. If you're going to get into that game, you're just not. And with an EV, the less weight you have, the more range you have. So, you know, people might criticize the interior, but that's actually what enables it to have a longer range is, you know, there's almost nothing in there. They made it very lightweight too. And so it's all kind of, you know, it's all kind of considered as a whole. They kept the cost down. They kept the weight down. It's about making the best product. You're not going to be able to make a better luxury interior with BMW than BMW. You're just not. So right. Why not take a totally different route? Go for this ultra zen, you know, simplistic approach. And was really kind of one of the genius design decisions that let them hit price parity with the BMW 3 Series.
Now, it is kind of interesting because I know they're working on a city car for China mm-hmm. and Europe and stuff like that. And my theory has always been Tesla is going to come out with a $25,000 EV globally, right? Mm-hmm. Or less. Because I mm-hmm. think that's what it's going to take for them to get that mass market adoption. I think of the city car as almost like the Civic, and then you're going to have the Model 3, which is going to be like the Accord, if we're like comparing it to like what's out there on the market right now from like Honda. And then you're going to have the S and the X, which are going to be the ultra luxury. Like it's almost like Tesla is two automakers in one. There's the mass market automaker, there's the luxury automaker, and then you have the solar company, and then you have this company that's selling like EV credits, and then you have I'm probably missing something, but like the other thing that people don't realize, and like obviously the stock has grown a lot over the past few months. It's sitting at like what, 2100, 2200 now.
Yeah, per share. It's just crazy.
Which is insane. I mean, we never thought it would get to that point, right? But people ask me, like, is this a fair valuation? And I actually say, mm-hmm. like, yeah, because if you think about the impact, just the impact that vehicle to grid is going mm-hmm. to have, like being able to use that 1,000,000-mile battery for energy storage, that's going to disrupt like the utility industry.
Yeah.
Like, that's the big thing. And then if you just think about software. Right? Like you see all of these companies that are being valued at billions of dollars building software. Like someone on a previous podcast told me, Tesla is a software company, like more than they are a hardware company. Right. Like this software is really the selling point. The autopilot's the selling point. The UI is the selling point. Like all this stuff, right? So I actually think this valuation that's out there on the market is like fair when you stack up like what they're doing on the energy sector, plus the software sector, plus making cars, plus being mass market and luxury at the same time. I think it's just so impressive. And, you know, like rightfully so, like all this hard work is really paying off. And there's still a lot of people who don't understand that. And because they think like, oh, Tesla's just selling cars. They're just like Ford or GM or whatever company, right? By the way, this podcast is sponsored by Ford. But that's the thing is that like you can't really evaluate like Tesla versus other automakers. Like they're not competing on the same field. It's like a totally different business.
Yeah, you know, I completely agree with you. And I actually think if they deliver on what they say they're going to do, they're still undervalued. And I mean, if you think about what were the biggest companies for the last 100 years before Apple became the most valuable company, it was oil companies, right?
Right.
I mean, that was the company that Apple overtook when it finally became the most valuable company in the world. It was Exxon. Mm-hmm. Okay. So if you think about it, every single thing you've ever bought in your life has gas as a component of the cost of that good. When you buy a can of Coke or a computer or even ask somebody to cut your hair, right? Gas was a part of the cost structure of delivering that good or service. So this is so big. This is every single dollar that's spent in the economy depends on energy. And Tesla's challenging the oil industry with a really radical solution, which is generate your own power on your roof or, you know, with a wind turbine or whatever, renewably, store it in a battery and then use it to power an electric car. And you never need to dig oil out of the ground. You never need to pollute. That's just one aspect of the business. Autopilot is, I think, probably the most important software project in the world right now. I mean, people can't imagine how big this is. And people really don't appreciate why Tesla is leading autonomy and that the emperor has no clothes for companies like Waymo. I mean, it's been like, 12 years and people are still pretending like, oh yeah, they're going to figure out autonomy any day now. And then they'll just open the service, right? No, it's not happening. And people really don't appreciate what Tesla is doing there and how big it is. I mean, since the dawn of... Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, what I was going to say is that, like my co-host Jason says all the time, mm-hmm. Tesla is the only company that is actually letting their customers be those test drivers. You know what I mean? Because Waymo's been testing their software on roads for years, right?
Yeah.
And
Autopilot has users.
Right. Autopilot has like all of this data, real world data from everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. Because when you're driving on autopilot, the system collects all of that data, right? And like versus, you know, you have some of these automakers who are like, oh, you know, we're testing autonomy. And they're like, okay, where are you testing it? We have a closed course somewhere in Michigan.
Yeah.
We're
Chandler, like testing Arizona, that out, Michigan, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And it's like, dude, like, you know, yeah, obviously, you know, I think we can both agree on this is that autopilot is prime time, right? You can use it as like an automated driving system, you know, for assistance.
ADAS, yeah.
Obviously, it's not full self-driving. You can't just take your hands off the wheel and,
you got to watch it.
Sleep or smoke a J or whatever, right?
Right.
But the fact is that when people do use it for that like automated driving functionality, it's collecting data. And yeah, you know, there might be times where you're almost going to merge in really crazily into another lane and, you know, you're not going to die, right? Mm-hmm. But those instances where you do take over the control of the wheel, like the system is being like recorded, right? So that way, you know, the training data that Tesla receives from that is ultimately going to improve the software. And the reality is that when you see some of these other automated driving systems, like I have one in my car, and it's kind of shitty and it's just like disconnected. Like it doesn't get better over time, right?
Yeah, probably like, mobilize something.
The functionality doesn't get better. And that's the thing that I think is super impressive about Autopilot is that by using it, it's getting better over time. There's updates that are being sent to it. And I think like no one can really knock that. Right. I think there's always a sector of people who are like afraid of innovation or afraid of technology. And they're like, well, how could you be putting this half-baked software out there in the world? And it's like, well, first of all, you know, when you're using the software, you have to be aware of your surroundings. Right. Mm-hmm. You can't just be like thinking it's a and I most people know that it's like an assistant. Right. It's not full self-driving. Right. It's not, you know, like a totally autonomous solution. Like you have to be.
Yeah. Every Tesla driver knows that. I mean, they tell you a lot when you're in the car.
Yeah,
every time
you
turn it on, they remind
you. Exactly. And but like I think there's just this faction of people who are like, because like I personally think this world was built for stupid people. And I'm also a person who's like, yeah, you should take responsibility for your fucking actions. Like if you like decide to fall asleep behind the wheel of a Tesla, like all of a sudden it becomes a news story, right? And people start pinning Tesla. But if it was a Ford, if it was a Subaru, if it was like any other car, right? Somebody falls asleep behind the wheel, like it's gonna be their fault. And I think like part of it is also this media narrative.
And you know, this is
like
a big problem. There's lots of people who die every day and get injured every day because someone fell asleep behind the wheel. I mean, this isn't a problem Tesla created, obviously. There's tons of people sleeping. Autopilot's the solution to this issue eventually. And, you know, I think it's interesting. Let's say I come to you and I say, John, I've got this autonomous software and it's ready. It's fully autonomous. Okay, well, how do we know that it's really autonomous and ready to launch? We have to go try it, right? You have to actually put it in a car and go try it and see if it works.
Right.
So, I mean, just the amount of time to go try it in the sun, in the rain, in California, in Michigan, in China, when there's a sheep crossing the road, when, you know, there's a drunk driver in front of you, to test it in every possible conceivable situation is just an immense task, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so the other guys, they don't even know if their system works or not. They've tested it, you know, in their limited capacity, but, you know, it's actually a lot easier than people think to make a very basic system that can drive within its lanes. It's very, very easy. Anyone can do it. And that's why you've seen all these companies trying autonomy, you know, everyone and their mom. But what's really hard is handling the 1 in a billion mile cases, where this is a very rare event. This is not going to happen often, but once every billion miles, it's going to happen, or once every million miles. Mm-hmm. That's what everyone's really trying to fix. So if you have to drive a million miles before you see this problem once, how are you ever going to test for it? It's impossible. Right. Right. So Tesla knows exactly where their system works and doesn't work because there's a million cars on the road with the software on it. Yeah, and it's constantly reporting.
Yeah, and ultimately, I think like it comes down to personal like responsibility, right? Like if you're still behind the wheel of a car, right? It's your responsibility to monitor like your surroundings and to make sure that you're driving in safe conditions. And obviously, there has been some tragedies linked to like the autopilot software, but I think ultimately people just have to use it properly, right? And that is what's going to drive forward like this vision of autonomy. Because otherwise, like you were saying, like we're not going to have all of that data from all of these different locations, right? And, you know, the fact that Tesla was able to pull this off without even needing LiDAR and having their work validated by researchers that say like, yeah, you actually don't need LiDAR, right? I mean, you see these two like LiDAR startups that are going public. Like, I'm just like, dude, like you're selling these units that are super expensive, right? Like people might not even use them. People are just going to like do the Tesla setup with like 8 different cameras on the car or whatever you have to do, right?
I mean, it's totally shocking. It's totally like an emperor has no clothes moment that I think the world hasn't woken up to, that these companies doing what I call the spatial approach to autonomy, where they actually have LiDARs and they actually map the space out, you know, very accurately. The spatial approach, the unit economics are just a joke. It's never going to make it to market in a way that's successful.
Yeah, I think it's like $10,000 for one LiDAR or something like that.
These cars, when you add in everything, when you add in the LiDAR, then you need extra computers to process all that 3D point cloud data. And when you add up everything, it's $250,000 to $400,000. Mm-hmm. Okay? So you could hire a driver for a long time at $15 an hour before that pays off. What you really need is to get an actual real car that's in mass production, like a Tesla, to do it. And this is really, really groundbreaking stuff. Because if you told me that you can drive a car with a camera phone, because that's essentially what it is, right? It's just, I mean, it's not a camera phone camera, but it's a camera, 8 cameras around the car plus 12 sonars and a radar. You just have these cameras feeding into a computer on an ARM chipset, not unlike what you'd find in an iPad Pro. And it's has a special chip in it to hardware accelerate neural network inference. But it's just doing computer vision. And it's driving based on computer vision. And everyone said, there's no way. Computer vision is not accurate enough for this kind of task. And it never will be. You need LiDAR. That's what everyone said. Mm-hmm. And maybe in 2009, when the Google self-driving car project, now Waymo, started, that was true. Mm-hmm. But a revolution has happened. I mean, machine learning is just growing and growing like crazy. You've seen neural networks just able to do crazier and crazier things, the way Google Assistant works, the way, I mean, GPT-3, which just crawled the web and tried to predict the next text, can just come up with all these amazing lifelike texts. The way that, you know, AlphaGo, beating the best Go player in the world, beating the best chess players in the world, beating the best Dota players in the world. Neural networks are doing all these things. So it's not really that, you know, there's necessarily, you know, such genius people at Tesla more than any other company, but they're riding the right wave of technology, of neural networks and deep learning advancing just at an exponential rate. And they've proven by shipping this product that the spatial approach to autonomy is a joke. I mean, you're going to spend $400,000 on all this extra hardware. Look at what we're able to do with just cameras. I mean, my car drives me pretty much almost anywhere, and I barely have to do anything. You know, I have to make turns. That's it.
Yeah, and I think, like, currently, I mean, when you think about what people are going to use it for, I mean, like I always say, incremental change or incremental progress is always the way. If you just get people used to taking their hands off of the wheel, right?
Yeah.
And it just being, like, hands-free driving, right? Like, that's a big step. Just on the highway, that's a huge step. Most people would appreciate that, right? Because, like, sometimes if you're driving a really long distance and you take your hands off and you take your feet off and you can just chillax a little bit, like, people appreciate those small moments. One thing I did want to kind of move along here, because I know I want to make sure I mention this, is Nikola. Because about a week ago, was it a week ago, you visited their headquarters?
Yeah, it was about a week ago, yeah.
Yeah, you visited their headquarters with some of the other members of the Tesla fan community, including like Tesla Joy, Sean Mitchell, some of these other great, they're also making some great content.
Love those guys, yeah.
Sharing a lot of great stuff about Tesla. And you got to know Trevor Milton, who's the founder of Nikola Motor. And you've been very critical of Nikola over the past few months, right after they SPAC'd and went public. Obviously, they're very interesting because they're developing both electric and hydrogen fuel cell technology. Now, personally, my perspective on hydrogen fuel cell has always been, how the fuck are you going to do that in the U.S.? There's no station set up. Most of the stations are concentrated in California, right?
Right.
And I think Nikola's like goal is like, whenever we get an order, we're going to start building hydrogen stations along that route. And somehow we're going to reduce the cost to like 20% or something like that, right? So I guess like my question is, what were some of your learnings or thoughts coming out of that session with Trevor and the Nikola team?
So, I mean, just a little background on, you know,
go ahead.
where I got to know Nikola. So, you know, I think most people who follow Tesla probably learned about Nikola when the Tesla Semi came out, which is an all-electric semi truck that Tesla has planned to release next year. And it goes 500 miles on a charge, battery electric truck, zero emissions. It looks like a great product. So Nikola, you know, Tesla was named after the inventor Nikola Tesla, who, you know, who came up with the design for this motor that Tesla uses. So Tesla named their company after Tesla in 2003. Then Nikola comes along and they sue Tesla for violating their design patents for the for the semi. So, you know, immediately everyone's reaction was kind of like, what kind of joke is this? You know, obviously you are feeling kind of insecure about the Tesla Semi coming in and threatening your hydrogen semi truck. And I mean, you named your company Nikola. Like, really, you're going to sue Tesla for copying your truck. But you know, years after Tesla was started, and, you know, Trevor Milton drove a Tesla, so he's very familiar with the company.
Right, right.
You rename your company Blue Gen Tech, which was founded in 2012. So the company Blue Gen Tech was founded, you know, 10 years after Tesla was founded. And they named their company Nikola. You know, it just seems obvious that, you know, they kind of want to ride Tesla's coattails, that Tesla's been the success, and we're going to sue them to get noticed, get people, you know, talking about us in the same sentence.
It's crazy because this company has been around for a while, right? I've been chronicling them for a little while, and I never thought much of them because it's like, getting into the auto industry is really fucking hard.
Right.
Like, you need so much money and patience. That's why nobody else has really gotten into the game in the U.S. I think the last major push that actually worked out for someone was when Kia and Hyundai came into the U.S. in like the 90s, right?
Yeah.
So it's like you have to really think about that too.
You're almost guaranteed to fail.
Yeah, right. But go ahead and continue. I totally interrupted you, but go ahead and continue.
No, yeah. So, I mean, that's true. You know, you're almost guaranteed to fail getting into the auto industry. And for Tesla to survive, lightning had to strike like 5 times. I mean, getting the NUMMI factory that Toyota and GM had because of the financial crisis and because people were going bankrupt. I mean, that was so lucky, lightning strike. And so many other things. I mean, there have been so many times when Tesla was just, it was make or break. They were about to die. right? Mm-hmm. So it's very, very hard. And so that was kind of all we knew about Nikola, was that they were suing Tesla. It was like, okay, you know, this is kind of, you know, just a joke. They're just kind of being patent trolls. And then kind of around, you know, when we heard that Nikola was going to go public, I started kind of paying attention to this company. And I found that it was just the funniest. I mean, we try and cover all EVs and everything that's happening, you know, with right. the electrification revolution.
Yeah, because you're not opposed to other EV companies, right? Like,
no, I mean,
you just call the Tesla's ones who deserve to be, you know, called out, right?
Right, yeah. Well, you know, I think it's important for everyone to make EVs. If Tesla's the only one making EVs and it's a niche product, Tesla has ultimately failed. If Tesla is able to convert everyone to electric cars and all the cars being sold are electric, Tesla, even if it loses most of its market share, is going to do very, very well because, you know, they've been doing EVs so much longer. They have such a huge lead. So that's what we want. And, you know, some people think sometimes I make fun of the other automakers, you know, for doing compliance cars, doing lame efforts.
Some of those are really shitty. Like my favorite compliance car was the Honda Clarity EV, which had a range of 60 miles.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, it's just clear that some of these people aren't serious. So that's why we make fun of them. You know, if somebody's got a good effort, like I think, remember,
Fiat 500e, the FCA CEO actually told people not to buy it because they lose like $10,000 or $20,000 on a unit they sell. So it's like, dude, why are you even selling it? Just have one out on the floor and make sure nobody buys it.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. You know, it's a classic case of the innovator's dilemma, where if they say, hey, here's this electric car, it's way better than a gas car, it doesn't pollute, you know, gas cars are terrible. Well, they've just destroyed their entire product lineup, and they've destroyed all their inventory, and they've destroyed all their capital assets at the factory that they were planning to depreciate over the next decade. So it's just a classic innovator's dilemma, where it's a very bad business for them to transition to an EV product line that's losing money and cannibalizing their very high margin product line. So that's kind of why we make fun of them, because, you know, they have to pretend they're doing it. They have to put on a big show and show the governments they're doing it and keep shareholders happy. But, you know, it's fundamentally bullshit. Most of the cars they're selling are gas. And these products have to be good. They have to be great. They have to be better than their gas cars and cheaper. And, you know, I think it's good what we're seeing. But
yeah, because I think like the EV mandates in Europe and China have really pushed these automakers to say, like, dude, we got to get our shit together. Because for years.
Yeah.
Right. For years, automakers have been saying, hey, yeah, we're going to electric cars. They're not making any money. And it's like, of course, they're not going to make any money because you don't have the infrastructure to make them. But once you have that set up, once you have your assembly line set up to make EVs, once you have the technology to like either create your own batteries or source them from a partner, like when you put that investment in, you're going to be equipped, right? Because the future is electric. You're not going to stop that. Right. There's not going to be someone that's just going to say, oh, yeah, you know, all of a sudden EV mandates, we're not going to do it. but it's like that's what's going to sadly, I don't think government should be moving this forward. But it is ultimately government that's going to push a lot of these automakers to like get their shit together, because the reality is they have the capital to make it happen. And the other thing is that I think the perception of electric vehicles like is going to change a lot when you see these batteries get insane ranges, insane speed, all of this stuff. Because it's like, so what's going to be
them
the
get into trucks?
Like, what are people going to like complain about? Like when there's super fast charging everywhere around the U.S., when, you know, the battery range can get up to like 500, 600 miles, you know, like what can you really say at that point, right? What's the rebuttal, you know?
And, you know, it's a very tough thing. I mean, they're replacing the whole economic engine of the world, and it's very tough for their business model and on just so many levels. I mean, the dealerships, 50% of their profits come from service.
Right.
But what happens when you sell a car that doesn't need service because there's no engine?
Yeah.
You know? So it's just very tough, and the whole industry is going to get shaken up. A lot of these people will probably die because the economic incentives are just so tough. I mean, it really requires a lot of leadership. And that's also why we try and kind of push them. But, you know, that's going to be, this is a really exciting time with the new battery technology and the stuff that's happening. Things are really starting to change very quickly. But
I guess real quick, before I forget, you know, we'll get back to Nicola in a second, but Battery Day is obviously coming up next month. Yeah. I mean, what are some of your predictions from that upcoming event? I think it's like September 21st, right?
Well, I'm not going to try and make a fool of myself by making too many predictions, but I think that Tesla's going to give us a plan to scale battery production to crazy levels that we have not even comprehended. Because if you think about what's necessary to make a million electric vehicles with high range, you need a lot of batteries. And this has been the principal bottleneck, is that everybody's buying their batteries from LG Chem and there just simply aren't enough. There's always battery shortages. Mm-hmm. And so what I think you're going to see Tesla do is they're going to have a diverse strategy. There's not some kind of wonder battery that is going to solve everyone's issues. And if everyone was just depending on this wonder battery, it would create bottlenecks in the supply chain where, you know, it's kind of depending on all the same materials. So I think what you're going to see is you're going to see Tesla do a few different strategies. They're going to have a few different chemistries, and they're going to be working with all suppliers. So they're going to be buying cells from CATL. They're going to be buying cells from Panasonic. They're going to be buying cells from LG Chem. Mm-hmm. But the real mystery that everyone's wondering about is what's happening on Cato Road. Because they have a facility on Cato Road.
Mm.
And what they're doing there is they're making their own cells. They're making Tesla cells. So traditionally, you know, cells have been kind of a commodity for people who don't know. It's like, it literally looks like a AA battery, a lithium ion cell. It's just really? A rechargeable That's battery. Crazy. Yeah. So what Tesla did was they said, hey, here's a crazy idea. What if we just took the lithium ion battery cells that are in your laptop and we just put them in a car? That was the original insight. So they literally just bought thousands, think around 4,000 cells for a Model 3, I think, somewhere around there. 4,000 battery cells. And they put them together into this battery pack. So the battery pack is a bunch of battery cells plus software to manage those cells. So that's why people think, oh, you know, Tesla's a hardware company. Well, no, the inside of the magic of this battery is really the software. Mm-hmm. And that's what people never really understood. So Tesla designs this battery pack where they can just take cells and then make this amazing EV battery pack. And hey, you know what? We can take this battery technology and we can use it in your home too. We can connect it to the grid and build giant batteries like in Australia. You know, it was the biggest battery in the world in Moss Landing in California. So they have all these uses for these battery packs. It's really their fundamental technology. But they were just buying cells from other people. I mean, you're not going to, at an early stage for the company, you're not going to do all this chemistry to make your own cells. But now now they have their own cells and their own production facility. They call it Roadrunner. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be some kind of machine that just makes these cells really fast. Just at a really, really fast scale.
Damn.
And there's some interesting technologies they're using. Like, for example, the dry electrode battery that they acquired from Maxwell. A lot of this is technology they acquired from a company called Maxwell Technologies. Right, right. So
that acquisition happened like, what, 2 years ago? It was very secret.
Right, right. So one of the things when you're making batteries is, you know, there's this complicated process where you have to, you know, mix these solvents and it's wet and then you have to put it in this industrial dryer and, you know, dry it out. And these industrial dryers are humongous and they take up a lot of room. They take up a lot of electricity. And, you know, you have to dry out the solvent first and then you can kind of make it into a cell. So Maxwell came up with this dry electrode technology.
Mm-hmm.
And that is kind of like a powder. And so you don't need those giant industrial dryers. It saves a lot of space. It saves a lot of time. And it lets you make more battery cells faster and also probably improves the properties of the cell, like the energy density and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they have another patent that they've been talking about that's important is the tabless electrode. So they found like, okay, the tab that comes out of the cell that you connect the wire to is actually a bottleneck because then all the current is going through this tiny little tab. So they said, okay, what if instead of having a tab, we kind of just made it longer and you could have, you know, it's too complicated to explain all this, but they have a bunch of technologies right. that they're going to put into some cell, and it's, you know, we don't know what it really is. There was a lot of speculation, and you know, people were speculating that they were working with this company Amprius because they were right next door. Then Elon was like, what? I've never heard of those guys, or I had no idea they were next door. So then it was like, oh, okay, that's not happening. So there's all this speculation, you know, it's really running wild. But really what we're going to hear from Tesla is, how are you going to scale battery production to crazy levels? And what technologies do you have to do that that we don't know about yet? And they've been keeping this secret for a really long time. You can just kind of tell, you know, when I was talking to Elon about it, when we interviewed him for our Third Row podcast, like you could see his face when I asked him about the dry electrode. He was like, that's a really big deal, way bigger than anyone understands. And so, I mean, this is big. I mean, cheap batteries, mass produced, would change the world. It would make renewable energy cheaper than anything.
Absolutely.
It would make electric cars cheaper than conventional cars, right? Imagine a world where your electric car is actually cheaper than a polluting car in terms of sticker price.
And it will because it also uses less components than a nice car. You know what I mean?
So, totally. Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah. So I'm excited for that day. I think that's going to be, you know, we're all looking forward to it. Obviously, it was delayed a few months, but like they say, good things come to people who wait. But I guess, you know, back to this Nikola story, though, because I know we totally just took a tangent from that. But
yeah,
your visit to Nikola, I guess, what did you learn? And I guess, what did you end up kind of concluding from your visit and saying, like, well, actually, you know, maybe they're not so shitty as I thought?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think the visit kind of reaffirmed everything I knew about the company, but it also, you know, gave me more empathy for them, having, you know, meeting them in person. So, I mean, Nikola was just the funniest EV story to me. Just like when you looked at this company, it was just so unusual, so strange when you looked at what they were doing. The business model made literally no sense. You know, it's just like they have this business model and it just, and you know, it's just my opinion, but it just doesn't sound like it's going to work. It doesn't sound like it's going to make sense. You know, this company has no revenue, no products, and just some of the deals they were making are just hilarious. Like, you know, they did a deal with the Diesel Brothers, for example, where, you know, every time they get a reservation for their Nikola Badger truck, which is pretty much just, you know, like a Photoshop concept that they put up and started taking reservations for, seems like. And every time someone makes a reservation for this truck, the Diesel Brothers get like, you know, 25 shares of Nikola or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. So the reservation was only like $250 and they're paying them like thousands of dollars of Nikola shares at the current valuation. And then there were just all kinds of things like that where you just look at the deal or like you look at the details and it's just so honestly just humorous to me. Just looking at the details about this company. And, you know, I was really enjoying just like following this story because it was just so absurd. You know, you don't see any company like that. And I think to some extent, there's just this strange phenomenon that's happened where the Tesla stock went up so much and Tesla did so well that people wanted to invest in clean energy and in electric vehicles. So you've seen kind of all this just SPAC craze, and a lot of them are just EV startups.
Yeah,
right?
Like Canoe, Fisker. Oh,
yeah, Fisker. I mean, there's too many.
Lordstown Motors. You know, it's and like it's funny because like as somebody who observes the EV space very closely, like I know what these companies like are doing, right, and I can tell you for sure that Fisker didn't, like, they don't even have an agreement with Volkswagen for their MEB.
They don't
platform.
Even know what platform they're going to be using. Right? Yeah.
Like the fact is, like, they basically told investors, they told people who were going to invest in this company, like, we're in discussions, right? And I don't know about you, but if I was running a company and I was going to go public, right, wouldn't I try to have those discussions before, like, going public? It almost seems right. a little fishy that they're, like, going through all this. But obviously, you know, Hendrik Fisker has gone through this before, right, with yeah. Fisker Automotive, which eventually became Karma right. Automotive, acquired by a Chinese company, and now it's back as Fisker Inc.
yeah.
When I try to explain that yeah. to people, they're like, what the fuck?
Well, the business basically failed, and they sold it,
Chapter 11.
The product 14. To somebody, yeah. 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 So, I mean, there's just so much of this, and, you know, so many of these companies are going to fail, and yet Tesla made it look easy. And so there are all these people who want to invest in.
Which it was not easy at all, right? No. Like, it was not an easy path. I mean,
right.
there was production hell. There was, it was just, you know.
It was a disaster.
It was a disaster. Yeah.
yeah. It was a total disaster. And, you know, I think people who've been following Tesla, they know this. And they know that it's not simple. No aspect of it is simple. There's just problem on problem on problem.
And raising $300 million, right? Or raising, you know, $500 million.
right.
It sounds like a lot, but it's not a lot in the auto industry.
It's nothing.
Right? And even it like, you know, the one other EV startup, I think, like, I personally think there's one EV startup I would take a bet on, and that's Rivian. Because
oh yeah,
RJ Scaringe, like, mm-hmm. he has said, yeah, if this was easy, if this was like a $500 yeah. million game, you would see like so many other players in it. But the reality is it's not, right?
Right.
And just the fact that they have that Amazon deal and they have that partnership with Ford, like, that's going to be game changing for them. Even if they don't scale up to be, you know, quite to Tesla's level, right? Mm-hmm. Like, even just having those like enterprise contracts with Amazon, like, that's going to be a good business, right?
Yeah. So I think Rivian and Lucid are the two EV startups with the most promising products, just based on what it looks like. I mean, I haven't tried any of these products, but other people have seen them. I think I've actually seen a Rivian, actually. I mean, Rivian makes really great-looking products. They seem like they'll be, you know, they'll sell, you know. But at the same time, you know, they've made a lot of promises for products. They've got their R1T pickup. They've got their R1S SUV. They've got their Amazon delivery van. They've got a couple other vehicles. So it's like, okay, a lot of people are excited about this. The product looks great, but actually getting it into production and getting it in people's hands, that's going to be tough, even with all that Bezos money.
Yeah, and it was delayed by like 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, I think.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it was supposed to be out.
That's completely typical,
year,
yeah.
But yeah, it.
And then, you know, where do you get the battery supply and all that stuff? So, you know, it's really tough. And it's just really interesting what's going to happen. On one hand, you have the legacy automakers who are kind of just sitting on their hands, putting out mediocre products. They've got the money, but not the will. Then you've got the startups. They've got the will, but, you know, not the money or kind of the stature in the industry.
Do you think that these companies are eventually just going to be acquired? Do you think, like,
well, yeah, the question is really who's going to
acquire like Hyundai? Because really, that's the only way I see like all of these EV companies that are going public, like a path to actually getting money back for their investors, right? And it would make a lot of sense because if you have like a Hyundai, for example, right, mm-hmm. just acquire Canoo, or just right. you know GM acquire Lordstown Motors, or like some of these yeah. like you know companies,
right.
I mean, I feel like that would be a win-win on both ends, no?
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess there's some debate about which way it's going to happen. Either the startups run out of money, and many of them will just fail, and nobody wants their technology. Mm-hmm. Some of them will get acquired. That's much more likely than them actually making the business sustainable on their own. And if the legacy automakers are in trouble, then buying an EV startup will start to look very attractive. The other possible interpretation is that investors are putting so much money into the startups and neglecting the legacy automaker so much that, you know, these SPACs end up buying the automakers and merging that way. So one way or another, I think they could come together. But it's, you know, if the auto industry is like a snow globe, it's getting shaken right now, you know?
Yes.
And absolutely. We'll see where everything falls when, absolutely. You know, the dust settles.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hey, I think we're going to wrap it up. It's been almost an hour and a half. I mean, this has been, I think, personally, the best podcast I've ever been a part of. super informative. And I hope you can join me again sometime in the future. I'm sure everybody listening would want to hear more from you. And you want to shout out your Twitter and your website or blog or whatever?
Yeah, totally. It was a lot of fun. I feel like we just had too much to talk about.
I know. But, and you missed the Neuralink. I'm sure
that's
you
okay.
Were like, damn, it's I
recorded.
Need to end this.
No, it's fine. I don't care. I was having a good time, and that stuff's all recorded anyway. But so the website is wholemars.net. And on Twitter, you can follow Whole Mars Blog. We'll keep talking about EVs and autonomy and all the stuff that's happening.
He tweets like, 20 tweets, 20 tweets an hour. what would you put your speed at?
Yeah, just, you know, whatever the physical limit of, you know, content is. So, you know, if that's not for you, then, you know, you probably don't want to follow. But if you're, you know, that into EVs and autonomy that you want that and want to talk to other people who are interested in Tesla and EVs and other things, then, you know, it might be interesting for you. It's pretty dumb. It's a lot of interesting stuff, but also just a lot of dumb stuff. So,
which, by the way, I think that's what social media should be used for, is mostly just dumb stuff, because it's social media and it's not real life. And like, I tweeted this the other day. I'm like, why is it that people are so funny on Twitter but not funny in real life? That kind of tells you like the state of the industry. Everybody's so quirky on Twitter, and then you see them in person and they're dry as a fucking bone. But I appreciate you jumping on the pod, and I hope we can talk again soon, man. It's great.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was fun.
All right, guys, we'll see you all next week or earlier than that. Take care. See ya.
Take care. Bye.
Sweet.